Hello, and welcome to episode 50 of the Live to Walk Again podcast. I feel like there should be some fireworks going off right now, Brandon.
Pop the champagne. What's up, Barry?
As always, my co-host, Brandon Stevens, is here. Brandon, you're back. Say hello to the people.
Hey. Hey, Jeremy. No, it's good to be back. I think I've missed the last couple of podcasts.
Yep. We had to...
We went on a road trip, and we visited the Redwood Forest in California, and then we also went to Yellowstone. And so we figured what better way to take a vacation, social distancing style.
Yeah. I'm glad you were away from people for the most part.
For the most part. We saw some beautiful country.
I bet. It's nice out there. I actually saw musical artist Citizen Cope. I just happened to see he was live on Instagram the other day and said that he just got back from a trip to... He road tripped it out to Yellowstone. I think he's from like Boston or something. So he made a hell of a road trip.
If you were there, you would see there's a lot of various different license plates scattered throughout the park. The cool thing about if you ever go out to Yellowstone, I mean, there's kind of a lot of people on the surface, but if you just adventure like a little bit past where everyone's at, there's like nobody.
Yeah,
most people kind of just stay to the road or within, you know, proximity to their car, maybe half mile, 1 mile. But as soon as you walk out a little bit further, nothing but open country just, and
beautiful, so it's beautiful land that hasn't been destroyed by...
On the trail and be careful of the bears.
Yeah, right, no doubt.
And the bison.
The bison, man.
A lot of bison. We didn't see any bears.
Did you have a bison burger while you were out there?
No, but
I had one of those before.
Pretty good.
It was pretty good, man. Yeah,
it's a lot less fatty.
Yeah,
it's a little bit more dry, but they're good.
Yeah, I had one when I was like 7 years old in Colorado.
Colorado bison.
It was Colorado bison, and I was like...
You were a little hipster when you were seven?
Guess so, man.
That free-range bison?
Yeah. Well, Brandon, you know, today to commemorate this wonderful podcast, we had...
Number 50?
Yeah, it's crazy, man. We're on 50. We're working on the Live to Walk Again podcast network, where we have some feelers out.
We've
got some big plans that are going to be announced in the not too distant future. But, you know, Brandon, I find it safe to say that we're both progressives when it comes to politics.
I mean, for the most part, I don't think that it's any mystery. It's mostly for people that have listened to the podcast.
Yeah,
it's...
if you've listened to a few episodes, you pretty much know where we stand. But you know, I was talking to our friend Willie Frank III, who was on a couple of podcasts ago with the amazing Shah Eyal. Mm-hmm. And we, after that podcast, we had discussed a representative that's running for the 22nd, I guess,
legislative
district here in beautiful Thurston County, Washington. It might even encompass more.
The legislative district, I think,
goes into Pierce County too.
And
a bit.
I think even South King County, but
or Lewis
we
County,
should have
maybe.
Actually
anyway.
I think it is South King County, but we should have asked. We should have asked.
Yeah. Anyway, so we interviewed.
We're not perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, you're perfect.
Neither of us are perfect. So we interviewed Glenda Breiler today, who is a member of the Colville Tribes, and she's running for this position in the 22nd Legislative District.
We changed pace a little bit as far as our guest this week. But
yeah, we just wanted to shine a light on, you know, because she is for Medicare for All, and that's like a big thing for me.
Absolutely, and we always, you know, tie it back in to the Surviving Proud, well, the Live to Walk Again podcast now. But at the same time, there's a greater good that we can contribute also, right, Jeremy?
Right, and she has a primary election coming up on August
the 4th.
That's what I thought. So she's It's basically, I guess, I don't know how many percent of the vote you need, but if it, I think it's top, it's the two, top candidates, advance, yeah,
regardless of percentage,
regardless,
right?
Of, regardless of party, political party. Right. So, yeah, and she matches up with a lot of our values as far as the environment and
healthcare,
education, yeah. So
social justice.
We just wanted to let her come on and, you know, give us her outlook on where things stand, like, yeah, how, you know, what she would,
yeah,
do.
We were,
we
were honored to elected. have someone come in and you know, use this platform for the benefit of everybody. Do you know what I mean? And that's, yeah, what this podcast is all about, essentially.
Yeah. And there's the thing that gets me the most is that there are no, like, there's so many Native American tribes in our beautiful state of Washington, and there are
29,
no,
I think.
Yeah, there are no representatives at the state
level
of any of the, no tribal member is, yeah, is at the state,
it's,
level,
it's
as
just
far
very
as representing our communities.
And, you know, we talk a lot about underrepresentation mm-hmm. on our podcast a lot, especially because, I mean, our podcast is a niche podcast, right? I mean, we're specifically targeting an underrepresented community,
yeah,
like people who have suffered spinal cord injury, who oftentimes don't receive the treatment that they should and deserve,
right?
Based on inequities, man. And so that's, we've done a good job at tying it in, I think. But I think overall, you know, what Glenda's speaking on, I think we should all be listening to.
I agree. I, you know, she was an amazing, it was an amazing interview. We just did it a little while ago, so it's fresh in our minds. Mm-hmm. And, I think she is, you know, she should, I would feel honored to have her representing me in our state legislature here. So, without further ado, we're going to let you hear from Glenda, and we will be back on the podcast in the not too distant future. Hope you all have a wonderful, blessed, safe day, and we will, yeah, we'll be back. So we are ecstatic to have Glenda Briler, who is a candidate for the Washington State House of Representatives in the 22nd District, a member of the Colville Tribes, and she would be the only Washington State tribal member elected to the state government, and only the second female tribal member ever elected to the State House of Representatives when elected. Glenda, thanks for coming to the studio today and joining us on the Live to Walk Again podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Brandon is also back in studio with us today. Brandon, how's it going?
Yeah, it's nice to be back in, Jeremy, even though last week I wasn't able to make the podcast.
it's okay.
Yeah.
We're excited to have
Glenda here.
We're so excited to have Glenda here. And Glenda, my first question for you actually is, what is it like running for office during a pandemic?
Yeah, so thanks for it. That is something that always comes up all the time. So, you know, I don't know what it's like to not run in a COVID-19 pandemic. I'm a first-time candidate, and... you know, I'm a bold, progressive woman of color. Bold, progressive women of color have been stepping up and winning against all odds nationwide. So I just had that at the forefront. The pandemic came in. I just continued to be a bold, progressive woman of color and just really believe in equity and representation and the need for that here in Thurston County in the 22nd Legislative District. So despite all odds, I've still been able to fundraise and, you know, raise over $33,000, mostly on individual donors and tribes from, you know, there's 29 tribes in Washington state. I'm a member of the Colville Tribe, as was stated earlier, Okanagan Band. And, you know, I just I'm running for the water, for clean access to water, air and land. And so, you know, I even though we're in a COVID-19 pandemic, it's more difficult to fundraise. I can't doorbell. I'm doing this for my ancestors, and I'm doing this for not only for my two-year-old son and the children to come. You know, with, as Indigenous people, we think seven generations forward and seven generations behind us. So I always say my ancestors have my back, but also I'm doing this for the children that are not born yet. The children to come, as, you know, Billy Frank Jr. would say.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Yeah, and I know our mutual friend Willie Frank III was trying to be here today, but he wasn't able
friend,
to.
Friend of the podcast.
Able to make it. Yeah, yeah. Friend of the podcast for sure. And he's endorsing you, so that was great to hear. You know, this podcast is generally focused on healthcare, or not healthcare, but on health issues, especially regarding people with spinal cord injuries, paralysis, things like that. We just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on, are you a proponent of Medicare for All? Are you give us kind of a rundown of what your healthcare policies would be.
Yeah, so I believe healthcare is a human right, full stop. I am a social worker. I have my master's in social work. So, you know, serving people in health and wellness has been a part of my life path. And I believe Washingtonians deserve a comprehensive plan that covers medical, physical, dental, mental health, and pharmaceutical care. I also believe the COVID-19 pandemic has spotlighted the inequities in our healthcare system and emphasized the urgent need for reform. And also the economic crisis has highlighted, unemployment and causes the healthcare system to unravel when those of us need it most. And in addition, you know, Washington State must reconsider how the government administers and pays for healthcare to guarantee access while saving costs. And I will fight to minimize out-of-state costs so that costs will not limit folks' access to quality care when they need it most. And I will be a champion for Medicare for All. I know that you and I are mutually Bernie supporters, and you know, I believe we can all do better with this, and that no one should go bankrupt from medical bills. And I will work to address how race and representation and equity play a role in determining health outcomes, and we'll center equity to rectify these disparities as well. You know, I'm a part of the BIPOC, the Black Indigenous People of Color communities and low-income people. I know that they are inflicted at a disproportionate rate, and I believe that during this global pandemic, this has been more pressing than ever. And to plan for a healthy, sustainable future, I believe we must implement a healthcare system that can withstand the stress of a major health crisis and health disaster. And this pandemic has made it clear that failures of our current system are just undeniably clear, and we cannot ignore the lessons learned from this moment.
That's amazing. I'm definitely happy that we're on the same page. I love that. I mean, just the fact that the healthcare should be a human right, that people shouldn't have to go bankrupt over medical bills,
with unemployment rates, upwards of 40 million people in the United States and their healthcare tied to their jobs, it seems almost, ridiculous to even have to discuss that. But here we are in 2020 facing a world health crisis, and people don't have insurance. And I just read a story of a young Black person that died recently in California, and he actually was very hesitant to get medical attention because he was uninsured. And that's just that's a hard pill to swallow. And we were talking earlier before this podcast started, and we were kind of talking about how Jeremy is somewhat in this like most vulnerable position to, if he catches it. And also he depends on caretakers and receiving funding from that. So do you have any thoughts on particular aspects of like caregivers, or have you done much research on those types of situations?
Yeah, I know, just speaking from personal experience, my grandmother, she lives in a very rural area on our reservation and is having difficulty having access to caregivers. And so my parents have really had to step in and be as supportive as possible. And they did recently come and visit for the first time for a couple of days, but had to go back because, you know, they need to ensure that quality care is being provided and that she's having regular visits as well. You know, in the community I'm from, back home on my reservation, they're doing, the tribe has come together to provide senior meals as well. So, but yeah, I think we absolutely need to invest in, you know, in social services. As a social worker who has lived paycheck to paycheck, I know what it's like to just get by. And it's, you know, caregivers, social workers, it's a very, it's a difficult field. And, and we don't go into that field for the money. It's not for the money. It's because you love working and serving people. And, you know, I'm a public servant. I've always wanted to go into social work, social services, because of my love for people and for social justice. And caregivers are not provided a living wage. Mm-mm. And I think we absolutely need to invest in social services. We need to invest in child care workers. We need to invest in caregivers as well, for especially our most vulnerable populations.
Yeah, I mean, this, I feel like the pandemic has really opened people's eyes to what type of workers are truly necessary, you know what I mean, or essential workers, or whatever term you want to put on it. But I mean, that's the truth. It's that, you know, the, like, my caregivers never had the, I mean, and I, so they're having to be extra careful because they're coming here, and I have to, you know, I'm worried that they're gonna, I haven't been anywhere basically since this whole thing started. And I actually spoke with a friend yesterday who's also a quadriplegic friend of the podcast, Simon Calcavecchia. And, you know, it was like the first time I had talked to somebody that was going through the same exact thing that I'm going through, because he deals with caregivers too. And I mean, he was just basically like, I'm at the point that I feel like I'm going to get it at some point. And like, that's terrifying, you know, because we also talked about, Brandon had sent me an article of a quadriplegic man in Texas last week that he got COVID-19. He had some other underlying health issues that I wasn't aware of at the time. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people do. And they basically had, he got COVID-19, had pneumonia in both lungs, and the hospital just said it's not even worth it to put him on a ventilator, so they just let him die. And I mean, that's seriously terrifying to me. So but yeah, I mean, it's that's the whole thing right now about, you know, essential workers and just people. I mean, it, you know, and how it's been politicized, the wearing a mask is, you know, you're a liberal if you wear a mask, and you're a conservative if you don't, or you're standing up for your freedom. And it's just it's mind-numbing a little bit how divided everybody is over
the mask wearing. Yeah, I just had my mailman ask me my stance on masks, and I said, until we have a vaccine, I believe we should all be wearing masks to the grocery store and out and in community. And you know, where even in the rural pockets of Washington State, I definitely see there's a lack of mask wearing. And on my social media, people from more of the rural areas I see have a starch stance against wearing masks. And I recently posted something where there is a person in full hunting gear, it said something along the lines of, why can you wear all of this gear and mask for hours, like 8 hours, you know, when you're hunting, but you can't go to the grocery store? I am very much on the other side from, you know, even in my own rural community where I grew up. And now I'm, you know, in a more liberal area here, especially here, very blue area here in the 22nd Legislative District. But there's definitely some stances, and, you know, we're a big community here. And so I am a definite proponent of wearing masks, as I came in with my mask. And
right.
I think that it's important, until we figure everything out, to all be on the same page.
I agree.
It's the way I put it is it's literally the least the thing you could do.
Exactly.
And it's so simple. And I just hate how everything gets politicized, especially when we're talking about science, and we just don't have all the answers yet. So what we do know is probably wearing a mask is not going to harm you.
Right.
But what we do know is potentially going around people who have the most vulnerability like Jeremy, that wearing a mask could potentially save his life.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've had this discussion on the podcast before about just, you know, being safe and wearing a mask. So we're obviously like glad that that you're on board with wearing a mask, but that should honestly go without saying at this point.
Right. So, Glenda, you had brought up that you're a big proponent of water.
Mm-hmm.
And when I had Shaw and Willie over a couple of weeks ago for an interview, we discussed that. And I had read about actually the reason I had Willie on the podcast was because I had read about the Navajo tribe in Arizona and how they've been affected like worse like per capita than any state in the country. At least a few weeks ago, and I came to find out that like 40% of the people on the Navajo tribe or on their tribal lands don't even have running water. And then Willie told me something that blew my mind, that the Nisqually tribe didn't have running water until 1970. And so I just I want to talk to you a little bit about maybe like the inequities of how like the Native American population has been kind of treated over the years, and mm-hmm. then, you know, like, and how that,
and also maybe how that spills over some of that into mm-hmm. other areas of inequities,
right,
in not on reservations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think I decided to run for this seat, you know, for many reasons, and most recently it has, you know, I like I said earlier, I had wanted to run for the water. I identify as a water protector. I've been on the front lines at Standing Rock. I coordinated a canoe journey there for 2 days on the Missouri to protest against the No Dakota Access Pipeline. And, you know, I also helped coordinate a canoe journey on the Upper Columbia, where I was able to help revitalize canoe culture there. You know, canoe culture has been revitalized here on this side of the state since the early 90s, late 80s. I learned everything I know about canoe culture from actually the Nisqually and Puyallup tribes, and was able to take that over to the other side of the state in 2016. Because of those experiences, because of going to Bella Bella and going 600 nautical miles with the Nisqually and Puyallup peoples, you know, the people of the water here, that have been here since time immemorial, that impacted me in this deep way where I felt so moved that I wanted to do everything I could to protect the water. And, you know, then that led into the No Dakota Access Pipeline, and, you know, fighting against the fracking that was going on there and the disproportionality of what was happening with the Standing Rock Sioux people. And you know, I in order to help people understand, you know, although I'm from the other side of the state, my people have lived in Washington State for thousands of years, and it's in my lifeblood to protect these living beings. It's, you know, I don't know if Willie has spoke with you before about this, but, you know, it's in all of us. We are the stakeholders. We're the stewards of this land. And, you know, we have been here since time immemorial. We have tried and true practices of how to create sustainability here in the Pacific Northwest, you know, in Thurston County, in Washington State. And I believe that we need to bring our tribal nations even more so to the table than they have been. I think we spoke earlier with this, but I'll say it here to the listeners. Since Senator John McCoy stepped down and retired from the Washington State Senate, there is no Washington State tribal members in the legislature. And so by electing me as your representative, I will be the one Washington State tribal member in the state legislature. And, you know, as you said earlier, the second female in the House of Representatives. And like I said, you know, it is in my lifeblood to protect the salmon populations and the natural habitats of the Salish Sea, the Columbia River ecosystems, and the coastal ecosystems. And that is through canoe culture that I have come to this. It's through the Nisqually people, it's through the Medicine Creek Treaty tribes and the Puyallup tribe that my spirit came alive, and that I wanted to do everything I could, even more so, to protect the water and be it a water protector. And I believe we need to keep our tribal relatives to the environment decision-making table. The state cannot address our environmental process without having the tribes at the table. Mm-hmm. That would be at the forefront of having me as your legislator. And we are in the crisis because of the state process, and we keep forgetting to keep the indigenous voices at the table. And how I help people understand about water and its importance is that we all come into this world in water. We all need water to survive. And we're all connected through water. And it's not just an indigenous issue. We should all be water protectors. We should all want to have access to clean water for our children and the children to come. And, in regards to disproportionality here locally, I would like to identify, acquire, and preserve tidal salt marshes and estuaries as they serve a buffer to the rising seas. And this is maybe something that Willie has spoke with you about as well, with the capital, restoring a capital lake estuary, and the dam removal of the Deschutes River Dam is at one of my priorities as well, to increase salmon runs. It is vital to the Salish Sea and Deschutes River to remove the Deschutes Dam, and to it's an ecological disaster that we have right now, right in front of the Capitol. And we need to create more blue carbon through an air estuary. And the Nisqually tribe has already been mitigating that through their Billy Frank Jr. Wildlife refuge. And, where the fixing where the Salish Sea meets the mouth of the Nisqually. And the 22nd district here is at the bottom of the Salish Sea. So everything that happens elsewhere gets stuck at the bottom of these stagnant waters here. You can even see that if you go down and check it out. And I want to do everything I can to invest in cleaning up our local waters and addressing in greater ecosystems health. And here, also in this district here, or in Lacey, is, addressing sewage and stormwater runoffs is a big priority here in Lacey, and including addressing the root causes of those pollutions. And we need to have indigenous-led task force. The people locally here are the people of the water. They've been here since time immemorial, and we need to move toward working with people that have a proven track record of sustainable practices for the next seven generations. And who are the people that are most disproportionately affected, by a lot of the local waters that need to be cleaned up, by the pollution, by fracking? It is, indigenous communities, it is Black communities, it is communities of color, it is low income communities. And that is where I, address the kind of how they combine with one another, equity, representation, and the fact that ecological, I guess they just go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. They just run on with one another. And that's exactly what happened with the Standing Rock Sioux community. That pipeline was supposed to go into another area, which was mostly a white community. And it was decided against the tribe's wishes, similar to kind of what you're talking about with the Navajo, to have that pipeline go through the Standing Rock Sioux community.
We're happy to, I'm pretty sure I read that there was recently a stoppage and a court victory for the Dakota Access Pipeline, which I've been seeing on my Facebook memories of some of the things I was sharing, and the anger I get from seeing that just battle for just water and just the life that it brings. It just gets so mad, and I try to just dial that back. A lot of times Willie would talk with us about, and you talked about it, the Nisqually River meeting the end of the Salish Sea. Is mm-hmm. that what you called it?
Yeah.
Well, he also talked a lot about you talked about the pollutants there. That's really affected their tribal treaty rights to fish there, and just, their harvest, their way of life. And I know that's been a real struggle. And so to loop that back into what you said about the sewage and the runoff here in particular in Lacey, could you elaborate a little bit more on that? Because I'm not even sure I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, so I believe we need to clean up Superfund sites and toxic polluting areas. I also, you know, especially those impacting frontline communities, which you just said, you know, tribes, low-income communities, and communities of color. And there are a lot of sites in this district that are impacted right now. As was said, we're at the bottom of the Salish Sea, so everything that happens elsewhere gets stuck here in this local community. And in addition, we need to build on ecology and building zones, which are stormwater rules, making it illegal. Currently, it's illegal to file a complaint about anything that developers are ignoring. We need to do everything we can to eliminate stormwater runoff rules. The city has had issues over environmental problems with new zoning. And instead of going back to the drawing board, we need to invest in lower density on-site stormwater runoff that would include absorption ponds. And so that has been a big piece of what I have gathered from talking with local progressive activists from the tribes itself. I know that we estuaries can create buffers for our rising sea levels, and one day, you know, it could be any day actually, the rising sea levels will take out I-5 here locally, just right here right next door here. And that's something I have spoken with Willie about, and having me as a representative, you know, I stress the importance and the value of having somebody who understands and knows and has worked with almost all 29 tribes. And I have, the understanding and knowledge of who every chairman is from every 29 tribes, chairwomen, chairmen, council people. And I think that's a really important thing, because understanding our sovereignty and that we're sovereign nations, it's like looking at 29 countries within one state. And the value of that. When new oncoming people come into the legislature, this is something I heard at the Affiliated Tribes of the Northwest Indians Conference that just happened. They don't know about tribal relations. They didn't grow up with a good friend like Willie Frank. They don't have an understanding of what that means, what sovereignty means, what government-to-government relationships mean, and why that's a valued importance, why treaties are in place, what it means, and the value of having our tribes at the table, especially our local, you know, Medicine Creek Treaty tribes. I usually will introduce myself and give a land acknowledgement and acknowledge that I am a visitor here in the Medicine Creek Treaty tribes. And that includes, you know, Squaxin, Nisqually, and Puyallup. And this was a traditional trading location where people would gather, the indigenous people would gather by canoe. And so that is inclusive of the Chehalis and the Skokomish. My family is Chehalis. My aunt is a Treaty Marcellia, a part of the Hazel Pete family, and she is the person who, you know, really connected me and helped me to become on the canoe family with Puyallup. And like I said earlier, we traveled for 2 months by canoe, 600 nautical miles from Victoria, BC to Bella Bella, BC, which is almost in Alaska. So I spent 2 hard months with, beautiful months with Nisqually and Puyallup, just and Squaxin side by side, learning their songs, learning how they are all protectors of the Salish Sea, learning how their hearts and their close connections and wanting to protect these ecological systems as well.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, we actually have a friend that joined the Nisqually tribe for a canoe trip from Canada down to back to the end of the Salish Sea there and the mouth of the Nisqually, which I was always blowing when he would tell me the stories of doing that. I was always blown away. So yeah. Sounded like a very, you know, spiritual and just amazing, amazing journey. So.
Yeah, I was able to see the canoes come in from the canoe journey in 2016, down at the Delta there, the Billy Frank Wildlife Refuge. And speaking of Billy, one thing I always remember when he talked about the water around here specifically was, I mean, his big thing was dead zones and this like the things dying, and nobody really knows like exactly what's happening, but the water here is not great. And so it's, I mean, I think people need to have a better understanding that, like, without these things that make our ecosystems run, we're not able to live.
Right. Yeah. And what Billy would say, I mean, even if you go and look at, I think there's a cartoon where they have him going through on a canoe. Sorry about that. And he talks about how when the salmon are healthy and good, that is the quality of the people, the local people being healthy and good. And the quality of life for the salmon is equally defined as the quality of health and life for the people and the community. And as Indigenous people, you know, we lived in a capacity where our salmon were running free and beautifully. And now we are seeing how salmon have been impacted through the damming of our lands and the need for, you know, and also, you know, I'm also a big proponent of culvert removals and creating more fish, investing in fish passages. I come from a community where the largest dam in the nation, the largest hydropower producer in the nation, which is Grand Coulee Dam, was built on my tribe's land. And so I deeply know the impact of the dams. I do know that the Deschutes River, the Deschutes Dam here locally, it's doable. It's doable to be, you know, I think it needs to come out. It needs to be removed.
They removed the dikes down there at the Nisqually Wildlife Refuge, the Billy Frank Nisqually Wildlife Refuge. And I remember that being a, like, how can we do that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you just do it.
Yeah.
Right?
It's not easy. My dad worked at a dam for 38 years. He says it's not easy, but some of these dams, it's possible. A Grand Coulee Dam is not possible right now. It's the largest dam in the nation. Sure. I mean, it would take a lot of work, but for some of these smaller dams, these smaller projects, you saw it on the Lower Elba, it's possible.
Well, I think also, you know, people often get water confused because they have perfectly potable drinking water here in this particular area. Well, that's not the case for every place. Am I right? I mean,
right.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about the importance, how you tie that in to just, you know, regular everyday water and the usage, maybe the quality of it. I mean, just right there, you know, in Flint, Michigan, they still don't have great drinking water, if any. And I know that's not our area, but to say that can't happen somewhere else is kind of foolish.
Yeah, so I'm trying to think of how to speak to that directly. I think, you know, really communicating with all of the districts and our community members, just exactly what you're saying about the quality of water and what are the biggest issues environmentally, and being clear to community members about this and bringing, you know, people, like I said, the Indigenous nations to the table to have these conversations, because I know, you know, Squaxin will have a different viewpoint than Nisqually, but we do know that our tribes are environmental stewards of the land, and that we can absolutely come together and have more clear, defined understanding of what is the quality of our water. What exactly does that mean? Like you were saying, with stormwater runoffs, what is happening in the laws in place that have not created or eliminated stormwater runoff rules, and being clear to the community.
We really have a problem with money being the most important thing a lot of the time. And right now we just don't have equal representation at the table. So I think having someone like you there to have a voice, I think that's paramount, actually.
Yeah. And I mean, with the COVID-19 crisis and going into the House of Representatives and dealing with the extraordinary budget cuts that are coming, we need to move forward and look at, you know, whose funding we're going to take away, and talk about how we should approach future budget cuts with an equity lens. Because the people who are most vulnerable from any budget cuts must be represented, and I am that representation. I come from, you know, one of the most low income, the community that is most low income here in the state. I am from a community that is vulnerable. Indigenous populations are vulnerable. But I also believe our tax system is upside down and hurting our middle income and working families. And we must, you know, work to implement a capital gains tax. And, you know, a part of that is remembering that environmental health is essential to our well-being. And we have to have strong policies that ensure communities are free of toxins, reverse climate change, and invest into a greener economy. And, you know, it is in the core of my ancestors to promote sustainable practices. And I believe that it is time for Washington State to lead on climate, income inequality, and ecological health by addressing our regressive tax system. In 2019, Washington State passed one of the most comprehensive and groundbreaking clean energy bills in the country, setting a goal of 100% clean energy economy by 2045. And to reach this ambitious objective, the Washington State Legislature must hold corporate polluters accountable for surpassing greenhouse gas emissions targets through fines and taxes. And the Evergreen New Deal, which is a big, you know, proponent of that, is AOC. Mm-hmm. And Bernie and myself, there will be a slate of bills to transform our forestry, transportation, agricultural, housing, energy, and resource management with bold, equitable, science-based approaches to create 100,000 new Washington State jobs while safeguarding our climate for the future generations. I don't believe we need to look at budget and environment and healthcare as separate. I think that we can look at it through all through an equity lens, and I think that is something that hasn't been there because we do not have you know, indigenous representation in the legislature. We do not have black representation in the legislature. We need to look at that, and we need to move forward together and realize that this is a problem. We do not have equity in our government systems, so we can't keep moving together without changing this. You know. I think the silver lining of everything that has happened with COVID-19 and, you know, with the recent, you know, everything with George Floyd has really brought to light equity and representation in a way that it wasn't, we weren't being heard. And we were just, you know, we were, even at where I work at the Evergreen State College as the Longhouse Director, I was pushing for training on undoing institutional racism. This is something that should be mandatory. This is something we should all be looking at, not just people of color, not just indigenous folks, not just black folks. I think recently everything has been highlighted. And, you know, a lot of us don't want to go back to normal. We want to go... we want to move forward to it with a new normal where we're not living in inequity, isolation, and depletion.
Yeah, that, you know, bringing up the George Floyd situation and you know, Black Lives Matter and the police brutality and things like that. I mean, what are your, where do you stand, I guess, on like defund the police and all of that sort of thing?
Or maybe even some ideas that we can put into legislation potentially, or
to combat that,
yeah, or just even where do we start?
So, yeah, there's a few things I have regarding the defunding the police. I believe in reallocating funds and investing in our community. I stand for moving toward reallocating the budget from the police to social and behavioral health services. As a former social worker who is highly trained in child welfare, behavioral health, and research in social sciences, I know what it is like to live paycheck to paycheck. I know what it is like to have high blood pressure working as a social worker at temporary assistance to needy families. I know what it is like. I have seen the revolving doors of social workers in the child welfare system. And the fact is that social workers live and work in an unsustainable environment, and our state is unable to retain direct practice social workers. I believe in creating a holistic police services that is inclusive of social workers, mental health workers, and chemical dependency professionals to work collaboratively with the police department. And to, you know, what recently has been highlighted with everything that happened with George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery is that, you know, police officers do not have, you know, ongoing training in social services, behavior health services, and chemical dependency profession. And maybe a training they go through is for a week once a year. So that training goes out of their minds, and I do believe police officers do not have an intense, comprehensive behavioral health training. And that is a need. As social workers have to continue educational credits and continue learning and relearning and as the field continues to change. And I believe we need to invest in having police officers do the same thing. And so that's a few things that I thought of as a part of the reallocation, prioritizing our budget, and creating a comprehensive memorandum of agreement where we're all memorandum of understanding, where we can all work together and police are on the front lines reaching out to community, but also bring in our very highly trained mental health and social service workers and have access to these services in a 24-hour capacity. I know we're not there yet. This is my big, bold plan and idea of holistic approaches, but maybe moving towards that and especially investing in our caregivers, in our social workers, in our behavioral health workers, and in public health, investing in our community health. I absolutely don't believe in taking away, and dismantling the police services. I believe in investing in our community care.
I like the way that you put that as reallocating instead of defunding the police. Like, yeah, just we're gonna spend money in other areas. And I think that's actually the message of defund the police more so than like actually doing away with the police. Nobody wants that, I don't think so.
No, and bringing everything together, the recent murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery, and the disproportionate toll of COVID-19 on vulnerable communities have only brought this institutionalized legacy of racial violence and white supremacy to the surface. And we need to be bold and lead in the action to dismantle structural racism within Washington State as it is long overdue, and dismantle it in our educational systems. Teach our younger generation from a young age, youth undoing institutional racism, and really highlight how we can all move together in unity.
Mm. Yeah, I wanted to, before we hold you up any too much longer, I wanted to touch a little bit on your education platform, you were speaking about the youth and reaching them especially from a social justice standpoint. And as a white guy myself, a white male, I have two sons, so I've got two more white males coming up, and having those difficult conversations. And me and Jeremy have had this conversation in the past. They're 10 and 6, and it's really not a conversation they want to have, I'll be honest with you, because right. I have not ever taught racism, obviously, but then again, I've never taught to stand up, I guess, if you will, or just like speak about it.
Yeah.
Tying that into just like the education platform that you believe in general, and from more aspects than that, I was just speaking from personal experience with my own two children, and Jeremy and I talking about how we weren't raised in that aspect, but also we weren't raised to combat it in any way.
Right, and that's the I don't know if you've read the book White Fragility. That is the that is why the privilege of being white, you don't have to think about it. You don't have to be upheld. And I think that's what trainings on undoing institutionalized racism or tribal relations trainings, government to government trainings are absolutely important, not just for our youth, but for all of our communities, especially for those that are, raising young white men and wanting to be good allies as well. And, I've worked in the education system since I was, 19 years old. I started at Western Washington University, mentoring and tutoring students in the Bellingham School Districts and indigenous students at the Lummi Tribal School as well, and recruiting students at Western to understand why it's important that these students need you know, tutoring and mentoring. They're vulnerable populations, high dropout rates. They need more. They're often first generation students, first in their family to try to go to college. So they just need more opportunities and pathways through mentors and through allies. And I have learned that good education is about layers of access and coming together to address complex historic inequities. I believe that, you know, in the K through 12 system, especially, teachers should also be paid a living wage. I have experienced what it is like in the pre-K system and the K through 12 as an educator myself and a preschool teacher, what it is like to go without health insurance, what it is like to live paycheck to paycheck, but just doing it out of my love, my deep love for serving youth. And also, you know, research shows young people trying to start up their careers in an economic crisis are at a lasting disadvantage, and their wages and opportunities and confidence may never recover. But what's amazing is a first line of defense is during an economic crisis, students actually go back to education. They go back. It's just such a beautiful way. As an educator that I have seen, and as a person who, you know, was just newly out of the economic crisis in 2008 with my master's in social work, what it is like, you know, going back to school and learning is just a bit bold, beautiful way to just increase your, you know, potential and quality in the workforce. You know, and as an educator, I plan to be a champion for high quality, affordable, and adequately funded public education, early learning, grade school, and especially higher education. With COVID-19, we see that our low income and communities of color are doing little to no remote learning. Nationwide, it's about 38%. That's just not good enough. And low income children and youth are likely to not have a device to learn at home. And so that is something that we're doing at the Evergreen State College, is providing access to devices, access to Wi-Fi for those students. That many students that we have are homeless, they live in the woods, and they need access to Wi-Fi. It should be a basic, you know, it should be a basic need, absolutely, full stop. And in addition to that, just you know, as my in my former role as the deputy director of the Washington Indian Gaming Association, that's how I met Willie and Pagan. I was able to work with 26 of the 29 tribes. It's an entity composed to advocate for the tribes. And my responsibility was to help with a scholarship program aimed to help tribal youth get into college. And another piece that I'm going, that I would love to be a proponent on, that I speak with Senator Emily Randall on, we recently had a fundraiser just focused on higher education, and I brought my mentors in and the people that I are just most near and dear to my heart. Higher education is just like a huge love of mine and passion. So the higher education system, you know, with the there's a bill called HB 2158, has been the most significant piece of legislation for higher education in years. It advanced the state's commitment to making college accessible in a way that has not been seen really anywhere else in the United States, and we must protect these advancements. And I will be among those that fights tooth and nail to retain its provision. And as I said, Senator Emily Randall worked on its implementation and passage in 2019, and we can, you know, we need to further create protections for higher education. I have been seeing my colleagues right and left being furloughed. Higher education needs to be protected in the same way that our K through 12 systems are protected. And that's an absolute piece of the platform that I am.
And free.
What?
Higher education free.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I mean, luckily we have a college here that is affordable.
Absolutely.
But I believe absolutely it should be accessible and affordable and you know, free. That is just a beautiful, bold way of saying that. It shouldn't be something that we're all just kind of looking towards. It should be accessible for all of us.
I wonder. I'm genuinely worried about the, as you mentioned, the distance learning aspect of education, and specifically in a pandemic. I just am very, very worried that there's going to be a severe drop off in the amount of people that are able to access education. How do you feel about the fine line of opening schools as opposed to distance learning? And just from the aspect of, like, for instance, here in our school district, we have money. right? We have taxpayer-funded computers, and there are some programs, I think, for internet, but there's nobody to oversee that specifically because they didn't have a great plan, obviously. Nobody did. How do you feel about that? I mean, I know it's very, as an educator.
Yeah, well, I've been a part of a COVID response and planning committee at the Evergreen State College, where we're all looking at what all of the other higher education systems are doing in Washington State and kind of trying to combine forces as much. We've never been in a global pandemic right. before as educators, and I know that our educators in the K-12 systems especially are struggling, especially for those young ones and those that are low income. Even, you know, my aunt who lives over on the Chehalis Reservation, her broadband is not great. Her, you know, even a lot of our rural areas do not have great quality broadband. And that is something that Senator John McCoy was trying to fight for, is having more accessible broadband, especially for our low-income rural communities of color. And I think those are the ones that will be impacted the most. And I'm hopeful that our instructors in our K-12 systems are looking into that. And that is something, you know, depending on when elected, what committee I will be on. You know, I know Lori Dolan here locally in position one. She's up for re-election. Is a big proponent of early childhood education. She, I believe, has her PhD in early childhood education, and I think she will do everything that she can to ensure that there's quality education for our early learners. And I myself will do everything I can, depending on which committee, whether they'll let me into the early learning or the higher education committee, one way or the another, I'm going to absolutely create this through an equity lens.
That's great. Yeah, we don't want to take up too much more of your time here. I know you've been so gracious to give us an hour out of your busy day. I know. Tell everybody, when is the election for, because this is just a primary, correct?
This is a primary. I am in a primary race. There are four Democrats, including myself, and one Republican, and so more than likely only one Democrat will cross the primary line. I plan on it being me, and one Republican. Republicans often take 30% of the votes. So, I mean, it's not unforeseen that two Democrats will cross over the primary, but to answer your question, August 4th is is when the election will be. That's, you know, we have 26 days. I have the X's on my calendar. But ballots drop in about a week. Mm-hmm. So, about next Friday, you'll see your ballots. You'll see your voter's pamphlet that just came through the mail. You'll have that. Today. We just got ours today. Nice. Military spouses are, and those in the military are able to vote already. I just saw my friend sent me a picture that she voted for me.
Oh, fun.
Also, you know, I have just wonderful endorsements from the Washington conservation voters with my environmental platform as an environmental steward and champion. And the Children's Campaign Fund, they have a soft spot for social workers and educators. And and also my own former union, SEIU 925, that has endorsed as well. I have strong endorsements from tribes across the state, and just received contributions as well, from the Lummi tribe, my own tribe, the Cavill tribe, the Kalispell tribe, Nisqually, and, I just received an amazing endorsement from Chairman Bean of the Puyallup tribe, and Willie Frank III has just been, and his wife, Pagan Frank, are just dear friends and have been helping me connect with everyone, to mm-hmm. you all,
yeah.
and
yeah.
I'm just so thankful for all of the supporters, especially my husband, who has been doing, 95% of our childcare.
Nice.
and he is my best phone banker. If anybody's ever interested in learning more about me, I'm at glendaforwa.com. You can help out and sign up to volunteer, donate, learn more about the campaign on our website. And we are really in dire need for phone bankers and getting the word out because we can't doorbell. So I'm reaching out to community members through podcasts, through local radio interviews. I did one just with Chaos the other day, and going out to small businesses and learning more about the community members that are serving our small businesses. And I'm a community organizer, have been since I was a teenager, and I would just love to serve this community as your state representative.
Well, we're you definitely think you have two votes coming from me and Brandon for sure, and
we'll be sure to put all of your contact information on the link to the podcast,
social media connections, all of that sort of thing, and again, thank you so much, Glenda, for coming out and giving us this hour of your day, and I think you made a great case for being the next representative from this district.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate your time and for letting me, allowing me the space to share my story. And I just, we don't say goodbye in my language. It's like we just kind of say hello and thank you. So, white limb limp and just tali has dapanat slahal. I'm really thankful to be here in this moment with you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.